You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
The love chapter. Some of you think this is going to be a sermon on marriage because, like, the only place you've ever heard this passage read was at a wedding. This is not going to be that. A wedding's a good place for these words, but it's not the original context for the words. The original context, as you just heard, is in this letter called 1 Corinthians that we've been studying for quite some time. The Apostle Paul is writing to a church in Corinth that he planted, that is struggling, that he's interacting with. That's the context of these words. This is in a discourse about gathered worship. And so it's not romantic love. It's not sentimental love. This is about the kind of love that Christians are to have for one another in a church community. And if we just zoom in even more, we see that these words on love are lodged right in the middle of a section that's about spiritual gifts and how those gifts are being used in the church. Because here's the deal in Corinth. The church in Corinth was a very gifted church. Just because of the city that it was in, it was made up of talented, successful, influential people. And yet, it was a very problematic church. And we've seen that, right? I mean, so many issues in the church in Corinth. There was like celebrity culture within the church. There was jealousy and division. They had lawsuits. They were suing each other. There was all kinds of pride. There was all kinds of immorality. There was idolatry in the church. I mean, the list just goes on. And it raises the question, okay, how can a group of such successful, talented, gifted people have so many problems? And the answer is because they lacked love. That is why Paul wrote these words. It wasn't like they were like, hey, Paul, we've got some weddings coming up. Do you got anything for that? No, Paul's looking at this gifted, talented, successful group of people, and he's saying, hey, there's so many problems, and my diagnosis is you lack love. These words were not written primarily to inspire. They were written to correct. This is a rebuke. And if we want to understand this passage, I think we need to understand it in that context. More than that, if we want to be changed by these words, then I think we need to receive them as they did. Which is to say, I think we need to hear these words first as correction, then maybe as inspiration and instruction. The Corinthians were kind of obsessed with all kinds of spiritual gifts, particularly the ones that were public and visible. And Paul's not against spiritual gifts. He tells them in the next chapter, like, pursue the gifts. But then right after that, he says, but let me show you a more excellent way. There's something more excellent, more important, more powerful even than the greatest of the gifts. It's the way of love. The Christian life is a life of love. And to an American audience, that sounds very flowery, very Hallmarky, because our definition of love is just love. Like, I mean, it's just very vague. But that's not at all what Paul means. And so the work that I want us to do today is to try to get some clarity about the kind of love that we're called to as Christians. And so we're gonna look at the priority of love. Like, why does it matter so much? We're gonna talk about the characteristics of love. Like, what does it look like in everyday life? And then we'll talk about the pursuit of love. How do we do it? All right, let's start with the priority of love. That's where Paul starts in this passage. So 1 Corinthians 13, verse 1. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers, I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I'm nothing. If I give away all that I have, I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. So these verses describe the problem in the church at Corinth. They had a lot going for them, but what they didn't have was the most important thing, which is love. See, love is like the fuel in a car. You could have a sweet car, all tricked out, I mean, looks awesome. There's no fuel in it, it's not going anywhere. And so in the church, love is what makes the church alive to God and fruitful in ministry. It's what really changes the world, is what Jesus says in John 17. And so in Corinth, they had what sounded impressive, eloquent speech, the tongues of angels, but they didn't have love, and so it was really just noise. What seemed successful, like moving mountains, was failure. What made them feel like they mattered, like what made them feel like they counted, you know, their generosity, their sacrifices, it all amounted to nothing. They were doing all these impressive things, all these good things, but for the wrong reasons. They were exalting self rather than Christ. They were busy building platforms rather than building each other up. And Paul says, like, yeah, you can have all kinds of good stuff. You can be really gifted, but if you don't have love, you got nothing. The tricky thing is, it doesn't feel like nothing. It feels like something. Like if we look around our church and we see so many gifts of God on display, we see generosity and sacrifice, we see people doing really good things, it's easy to think like, well, we must be doing something right. I mean, God must be really pleased with us. At an individual level, it's easy to do this. It's easy to see God using us and think, man, I must be doing okay. I must be really like spiritually far along. And we do it with others all the time. If we see someone who's really gifted, if we see someone who is really smart, you know, they really have their theology down. Even someone who's like socially connected within the church, we equate these things with some kind of spiritual vitality or maturity. We think if they're doing well and God's using them, they must be really mature. And you know, like from the news, that's not the case. Sadly, we have so many examples of Christian leaders who are doing great things, but internally they lack the kind of character and love that Paul is calling us to, that God calls us to. It's so easy, it's so common to conflate gifting with character. But Paul says you can be gifted and not loving. You can be talented and smart and connected and internally be very far from God. Happens all the time. Jesus says, in fact, you could be very gifted and not be a Christian at all. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? Did we not cast out demons in your name? We did many mighty works in your name, right? Gifted people doing impressive things. And Jesus said, I will say to them on that day, depart from me, I don't know you. Giftedness is not the same thing as character. Paul is prioritizing the character of love in the life of a Christian. If you want to have knowledge and gifts and great service, great. But if you don't have love, you got nothing. Ephesians 4 is a passage that we talk about a lot. We talk about it in our membership class. And in that passage, there is an emphasis on the gifts that Jesus gives to the church. There's an emphasis on knowledge and truth and doctrine. But the point of the whole thing, like the culmination of the passage, is that the church builds itself up in love. If you have gifts and you have knowledge and you don't have love, you got nothing. I think I've shared this story before, but it's just stuck with me over the years. I was at somebody's birthday party, one of you guys, I think, and your GC was there, and I just got to talking to a guy who was at the party who was in the GC but doesn't go to our church, so I didn't know him. Wasn't a Christian, and you know, a lot of people, when they find out I'm a pastor, they're trying to get like an exit strategy in place. They're trying to get out of that conversation as fast as they can. Sometimes when people find out I'm a pastor, they see it as an opportunity to just unload their life on me. I like the latter. I think that's more fun. And this guy saw it that way. And so he just wants to start talking to me about his life. And the first thing he starts talking to me about is pornography. Is this going to be an interesting conversation? And he's talking about how he's always watched pornography and he's never really thought about it being wrong. But lately he was starting to think maybe it was. He was starting to feel some guilt and shame around it. And I asked him, why do you think that is? Like, why do you think you're feeling different about that now? And I won't go into the whole conversation, but the short answer is love, which is surprising. He went on to talk about how he had experienced such love in his gospel community. He said, I've never been a part of a community like that. I've never really known what it means to be loved, and these people have taught me what it is like to be loved. And the reality is that the riches of love in that community were shining a light on the poverty that is pornography. Pornography is not love. It's the opposite. It's objectification, self-seeking. It doesn't move you toward people. It isolates you from people. He was experiencing the contrast of these things, and it was changing his heart. Of course, there were gifts in that GC. Of course, they were talking about the truth. But the point of all of it was the love in the community. That's what changed this guy. Right? Love is the priority. We need love. All right, so what does it look like in real life? That's the bulk of this passage. We're going to spend most of our time here. Look at verse 4. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It's not arrogant or rude. It doesn't insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. 16 descriptions of love, of what it is and what it isn't, in 3 little verses. So right away, you can get a sense for just the breadth and the depth of love. This is not even an exhaustive list. In other places, Paul uses other words like love. There's so many ways you could talk about it. A few observations about this list. The word here is agape. So, you know, the Greeks had several words for love. They used words to distinguish between things like pleasure and friendship, or even like compassion. Agape, the unique thing about agape is that it's not based on emotion or desire. Agape love is based on a choice. It's really like a character of quality, or a quality of character, I should say, that genuinely wants good for other people and routinely chooses to act according to that desire. Agape love is being the kind of person who wants good for people and acts on it. And that's the key. Love is not something that we have or feel. Love is something we do. It's action. For the last couple weeks, as I've been reading this passage around the house, I've been telling Debbie pretty frequently how loving I am. Even yesterday, I was telling her, I think my muscles are getting bigger because the love's expanding in me. Like, it's just, there's so much love. This has been a daily conversation. I've been trying to convince her just how loving that I am. And I don't understand why, but she doesn't seem impressed by the words, you know? Because love isn't talk. Love's something you do. Romans 5:8 says, God shows his love for us in this, that while we were sinners, Christ died for us. So the evidence of God's love toward us is not something that he felt toward us, though he did. The evidence of his love is something he did for us. He showed his love. He demonstrated his love by sending his son to die. He chose to act for our good at great cost to himself. In John 13, which is really the basis of this whole chapter, Jesus tells his disciples, love one another as I have loved you. And when he said that, that came on the heels of him washing their feet. He showed it in action. It's an object lesson for the kind of love that he's talking about. This description of love is very skillfully aimed at the problems in Corinth. So all of the words that Paul uses have already been used in the letter, but they've been used in reference to their problems. For instance, when Paul says, love does not boast, well, that's a reference to earlier chapters where he was talking about how they're just boasting so much about their wisdom. All of the words are like that. It's pretty masterful if you think about it. He's like praising love and at the same time rebuking their lack of love. Let's look at it together. Verse 4, love is patient. Love is patient. As we go through these, this is what I have found most helpful. We're gonna look at all of them. So just try to like meditate on them as we go. Think about which words kind of touch various situations or relationships in your life as we go. Love is patient, long-suffering. The thing about acting for the good of others is that it's hardly ever easy. It usually involves suffering with them or for them. It might involve being ignored or rejected by them. Acting for the good of others almost always involves waiting, because the good that you want to see in people's lives, it doesn't happen overnight. You got to stay with people for the long haul. I was thinking during the first song about this verse in First Thessalonians 5, I believe. No, yeah. Paul says to them, be at peace among yourselves, and we urge you, brothers and sisters. So this is what he wants not the pastors to do, he wants the church to do to one another. We urge you, admonish, warn the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all. You see, patience isn't just sitting by idly. We are warning, we are encouraging, we are helping, and all of that just requires so much patience because people take time. Love is kind, which just means it's tender, it's gracious, it's considerate of others. Part of this word means useful, right? It's looking to serve. So in the context of gathered worship, kindness means I'm not just walking in here and only thinking about myself. I'm thinking about how I might be useful to others. Kindness looks around the room and realizes everyone in here is carrying a heavy load. A load which could be lightened a little bit with some kindness. Sometimes our patience is begrudging and judgmental. Like I might bear with someone, but then later complain about that or talk about them behind their back. I might bear with someone, but kind of in some regular intervals remind them of just how much patience they're requiring of me. Right? Eventually, you'll say things like, man, people are just difficult. Kindness, agape kindness, isn't bothered by the waiting. It's kind, it's gracious. One person said that kindness is like the atmosphere around you. How do people feel around you? Do they feel safe, seen, cared for, at ease? That's what kindness does. This is a core characteristic of God's love. Romans 2, Paul's talking to people who are far from God, paying no attention to God, and they assume God doesn't even care or see their wickedness. And Paul says, no, you've mistaken it. The reason he allows you to go on like this is because he's patient and forbearing and kind. Do you not realize that it's his kindness that leads you to repentance? God is so patient with you, so kind toward you. He waits. He's not sitting idly by. He wants you to repent. Love does not envy. So love sees what others have. It sees what others are experiencing, and it's just happy for them. Envy sees what others have. It sees what others are experiencing, and all I can think about is how I don't have that and how that's not happening to me. This is what's happening in Corinth. You know, we saw it last week. The foot thinks that it would matter more if it were the hand, and the ear wants to be the eye, and so on. And Paul corrects them, saying, no, God has arranged the parts of the body as he sees fit. And the point for us is it doesn't matter where you are in the body or what your role is, wherever you are, whatever gifting you have, everyone has the opportunity to do the thing that matters the most, which is to love people. There is unlimited potential for that, for everyone. Love does not boast. Right? The Corinthians boasted about their status. They boasted about their knowledge, their gifting. This is really about words and drawing attention to yourself with words. And this is something the Corinthians loved. They loved words. Sophisticated, eloquent, mysterious, deep. They loved going deep. And that meant sounding really smart. And Paul's like, hey, that might sound impressive, but it's not helping people. Love wants to help people. Love dies to the desire to make the conversation about me. As if that's what people really need. You know what I think people really need is just to hear more about my strengths and successes. That would really help them. Never. Never. Love is not arrogant. The Corinthians were puffed up. That's what the word means, puffed up. They were puffed up about their tribe, their camp. You know, some followed Paul, some followed Apollos, and they prided themselves in it. They argued about it because that's what happens. If your identity is tied up in being right or being on the right team, then you will argue about it. You will constantly need to prove that other people are wrong because pride is always seeking to be validated. See, love's not like that. Love rests in what the Bible calls justification, which just means that God has declared us righteous, right with himself. I stand in right relationship with God because of Jesus. And that kind of assurance, that kind of peace allows me not to constantly need to be validated by being right in other things. Love just rests in God's approval and doesn't need it from everybody else. Christian community involves learning from one another and, as Paul says, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. But if you think you know more than everybody and you think you know better than everybody, it's gonna be really hard to learn from people. It'll be even harder to submit to them. Love's not arrogant. It's not rude, meaning it doesn't offend unnecessarily. The gospel is offensive to everyone in every culture, and necessarily so. But love doesn't offend unnecessarily. It doesn't act in ways that are shameful. It doesn't violate the dignity of others. It's considerate of others. Love is not, it doesn't insist on its own way. So all of us naturally want our own way. And to some degree, that's kind of just okay. It's normal. The key word here is insist. Love does not insist on its own way. So in community, there will always be a clash of preferences and desires. And arrogant pride will fight for its way. We'll try to win out on its preferences. But there's another kind of pride. There's a fearful pride that will give in the moment, give way to other people's preferences, but internally, there'll be a little pity party. There'll be some bitterness. See, both arrogant pride and fearful pride are both just focused on self. Love's different. In the clash of preferences and desires, love steps back and thinks about what would be good for people. And then it acts accordingly. Love, Jonathan Edwards says, love finds happiness in the happiness of others. I love it when you get your way. I've never thought that genuinely, but that's what love would think. I love it when you get your way. Love is not irritable, which means easily provoked, easily angered. If you think you know best, then you're going to be irritated when people are missing the point. You're gonna be irritated by people's slowness to get it. You're gonna be irritated when people are doing things in a way that you wouldn't do it because, I mean, your way is the best. So you're gonna say things like, people are so stupid. Here's something I say out loud. Pretty frequently, I will say, man, what is wrong with people? That's not loving. That's me being frustrated that people haven't arranged their lives to accommodate my comfort. Right? They're making my life harder. That's what's wrong with people. It's irritable. Irritable people don't do well with interruptions and frustrations. Like if you're around a person like that, if you're in community with someone who is easily provoked, easily angered, you know what you do? You sort of try to keep a safe distance from them because it doesn't ever feel worth it to like rock the boat. Nobody wants those ripple effects. Right? Well, listen, relationships in which we keep a safe distance from each other, that's not biblical community. Biblical community is me being all up in your stuff and not being irritable about it. It takes a lot to make love angry. And when you do make love angry, it quickly forgives. Love is not resentful. Some translations say it doesn't keep a record of wrongs. So if you're self-seeking and you're easily angered, then things are gonna be very, very, very personal to you. Like when people do it wrong, or when people wrong you, you won't forget it. Somehow it's part of who you are now. And it taints the relationship, doesn't it? Like are there people in your life that you just have a hard time even being around without feeling something negative? There are people in your life that that even when they do great things, you don't want to encourage them because you don't want them to be off the hook for this thing that you're holding resentment over. Anybody like that? It's just me? Okay. What I find is when I'm holding this record of wrongs with people, on the outside it looks fine. I'm a professional. I can be around people and smile and act like everything's fine. But on the inside, I'm a little bit mad. I a little bit want them to be exposed. Given the opportunities, I'll take a little jab to remind them of the thing that they did, to rekindle old hurts. And then I'll say I was just joking because that makes everything okay when you add that. Love, though, is not preoccupied with wrongs suffered. Love is not looking to point out sin. Peter says love covers a multitude of sins. The image is like a curtain being pulled down over a stage. So imagine a stage where if you're the solo actor, and the unique thing about this stage is that the audience can see all of your failures. See, love wants to close that curtain. Love wants to cover up. Not so the person can get away with it, but so the person's not alienated by the community. Resentment wants to fling the curtains open, shine the spotlight on it, wants everyone to see just how bad this person is and what they did. Love says, no, let me cover it up so that this person can deal with sin in the context of a loving, caring community. Why would we alienate? That's resentment. Love is to bring in, to care for. Love does not rejoice at wrongdoing. Right? Love's not soft. Love hates injustice. Love grieves sin. It's not soft. If you're proud, then one of the things you're gonna feel is like when other people have setbacks, you're gonna kind of feel good about that because it means you're getting ahead. If you're irritable, then you're gonna feed that anger by keeping note of people who do it wrong. If you're resentful, then you're gonna feel vindicated when the other person messes up or when bad things happen to them. That's pretty wicked, isn't it? But we all do that. Love does not delight in these things. It laments them. Love rejoices with the truth. It doesn't suppress the truth. It doesn't resist the truth. It rejoices with the truth, whatever the truth is. So we have this thing about us that we're like, it's true if it's true to me. So if God says it's true and it's true to me, then it's true. And the Bible does not present truth that way. Jesus says, I am the truth. So whatever in your life doesn't accord with me, that's not true because I'm the truth. Love rejoices with whatever is true, even if the truth exposes us. So like just looking at these three verses exposes us, doesn't it? If you don't feel exposed, I don't think you're being honest with yourself. And I would understand that because it's hard to do. Like we like to think of ourselves as pretty loving people. Most of us see ourselves that way. But then you read these verses and you're like, I don't know. Maybe not so loving. But we rejoice with the truth, even if it exposes us. Why? Because now we can see clearly. Now we really understand our need for Jesus. Now we can repent of our unloving ways in community. Now we can confess and be forgiven and cleansed. Now we can be filled with the Spirit to truly love one another as we're called to. Agape love rejoices with the truth, whatever it is. Love, this is the last thing, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. The idea here is that love does all the things in this list and keeps doing them. So we all have our moments. Some of us even have seasons where we're like really loving people pretty well. But eventually we lose steam, right? I mean, stuff's going on in our life, we get distracted by it, or we get to the place where we just don't know how to help the person anymore, and we find out the reason we were so loving is because we like to be thought of as the person who's very loving, but once we don't have a way to help anymore, we kind of fade. Things happen, and our love wanes, and what Paul's saying is agape love just never loses steam. It keeps going. It keeps hoping, it keeps praying, it keeps trusting God. It doesn't give in to weariness. It doesn't give in to cynicism. It doesn't give in to opposition. It keeps going. It never ends. It always believes that God is able to transform anyone's heart. That's the power of agape love. Frederick Buechner said, "The power of agape love is seen in Beauty and the Beast, in which beauty doesn't love the beast because the beast is beautiful, but rather makes the beast beautiful by her love." That's our story. God set his love on us, not because of anything in us, not because we're pretty or talented or successful or we would really bring something to the table for his kingdom. Not for any of those reasons. He set his love on us because he's loving. And by his love, he makes us beautiful. He makes us gifted. Jesus said, "Love one another as I've loved you." And the one another is not just the people you like. It's the kind of people Jesus loved, the outcast, the sinner. Love people that are difficult for you to love and stay with it. Don't lose steam. Wait for God to do something. And that brings us to the last question. How do we do it? How do we do it? If you are reading this list and you're like, "Okay, I think I can do this," you're wrong. The wrong way to look at these verses is to think about your ability or inability to do it. That's not the point. The point is, this is like not a list of commands that you should do. This is a description explicitly of what love does. So I think what Paul's doing here, he's using these very stark verbs to personify love, meaning he's not pointing us to some ideal of love. He's pointing us to the concrete embodiment of love in the person of Jesus. Jesus is love. If you want to pursue love, pursue him. Jesus is patient and kind. Jesus looks down on us not to condemn us, but to have compassion on us, and then he becomes one of us to save us. Jesus doesn't come to bury us in guilt. He comes to take our guilt away. Jesus doesn't lord over us. He washes our feet. Jesus was not about the attention. Often he withdrew from the crowds to seek the Father and to pray, to wait on him. He didn't rejoice in the consequences of sin in the world. He wept over them. And even though his own people rejected him, his disciples abandoned him, on the cross, Jesus cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Even in then, he didn't lose steam. He loved us to the very end. And Paul says, now, nothing can separate us from this love. God shows his love by sending his son into the world. And it's not just a display of love, it's an invitation into love. He brings us into his love by adopting us into his family, by uniting us with Christ. And then he fills us with his love by his Spirit. Paul says in Romans 5 that God has poured out his Spirit into our hearts, or poured out his love into our hearts through his Spirit. It's comprehensive. It's not a show, it's a relationship. And so when Paul says, pursue love, he doesn't mean look at the list and try really hard to do that. He means pursue Christ. Receive his love. Experience his love. Enjoy his love. Know him so thoroughly that his love changes your identity, changes your sense of self, and fills you up to overflowing. That's how other people will experience your love, because you've experienced it in Christ. Look, we can only give to people what we've received from Christ. So pursue him. Be about him. Then let his love flow through you. I think there's a lot of love in this community. I really do. But there's also a lot of gifting, a lot of talent, a lot of smart people, which is good. But it would be easy to mistake that stuff for the stuff that really matters most. It would be easy to think, well, we're growing and people seem to be doing pretty well and God must be really pleased with us. Let's not do that. Let's not prioritize the wrong things. Let's prioritize love. And let's pursue Jesus together, the person who is love, the person who has love, the person who gives us the love that we're called to have. Let's seek him together.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.